from runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 167 with guest Mark Manassi, recorded Wednesday, June 30th, 2010. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. You're listening to Run As Radio, and as I promised or threatened, we're just going to continue the conversation with Mark Manassi, another show. The man needs no introduction. He's thinking about these problems all the time, and we were ready to change gears in our last discussion, so I thought, let's just break it up. We'll make it another week, another show. Welcome back, Mark.
It's always good to be here, Richard.
You haven't gone very far. It's true. So, what do you want to talk about, my friend?
Well, you know, last time we talked about Office and where Office could go, and we kind of drifted off to something else, which I think was not useless stuff. And, you know, because Windows 7 is out, I mean, it's been out for nigh on to a year now, because I guess, what was it, late August?
And very well received, I mean, by everybody's standards. So they're selling like hotcakes.
Which, again, I'm happy for Microsoft. I like Windows 7. I ain't beating on it. But I'm still astounded that I'm the only person that liked Vista. And if you know Vista, Windows 7 just isn't that terribly different.
Right. True.
So it's
enough.
All about the marketing. Maybe that's the what it comes down to.
Well, and there was a great stat in one of the mags the other day that said there's a 7 copies of Windows being sold per second.
I always wonder about those numbers, yeah, though, because, you know, when Microsoft talks to Procter & Gamble, I'm making this up, Procter & Gamble for 4, 5, 6, 8, 9 months, and then Procter & Gamble says, okay, you've helped us, you know, Chris Jackson's gone down and helped them figure out some compatibility issues, and they sign for, and I have no idea how big Procter & Gamble is and whether they use Windows or not, but, you know, let's say 75,000 seats.
Right.
That's sort of, bam, you know, that's a lot of seconds there.
Yeah, you just banked a whole bunch of seconds.
It does seem like there's a lot of it, though. I went to my dentist yesterday, and they have all kinds of, they got a computer screen now that sits over me while they're doing whatever they do. And one of them is, of course, when they take x-rays or things like that. Nowadays, it's just a little doodad on a USB.
Right.
And I noticed as it was not working, that the program, when it, that was not working, that they had the Windows 7 screensaver. I said, you guys went to Windows 7? They said, oh, yeah, there was a lot of really good features. And so we thought, and I'm thinking to myself, this is why it costs so much to get my teeth cleaned.
Yes, it's true.
Anyway, so you're running Windows 7 over there at RunAs?
Oh, yeah.
How about Server 2008 R2?
I've got a little bit of everything, my friend. Let me tell you. I'm still recording on a Vista machine because it works. I've got a Windows 7. My main dev workstation is a Windows 7's box. In the server closet, there's some 2008. There's one 2003 R2. There's a couple of 2008 R2s and at least a couple of cores of both 2008 and R2.
I am all the way up to almost entirely Windows 7 and 08R2. My web server is still 03R2 because it's my most complicated server by several orders of magnitude, and I just haven't had 2 weeks to get a new machine.
There are machines that you fear, and my 03R2 machine is also a web server.
What a surprise.
Running about 25 different co-load sites on it, none of them of particularly high volume. And yeah, you don't take that machine apart lightly, although I'm very close to just sticking SCVMM on it and sucking it into its own virtual machine inside of the cluster of VM machines I'm running now.
So you, in cowardly fashion, would not go to 08R2. You would simply remain with an 03R2 32-bit system.
I would start migrating sites individually. So my new portable server rig, which you have met before, has now been migrated. The web servers are migrated to 08R2 core because that will run ASP.NET.
It will.
Not
that's right.
4.0. It'll only run 3.5 SP1.
All the PowerShell stuff and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. But the bottom line is the leanest, meanest web server you can get today from the Microsoft stack is 08R2 core. You can't argue with how small the footprint is, how small the attack surface area is. It's a lovely machine.
Some really good numbers I heard from Andrew Mason, who is Mr. He calls himself Mr. Server Core at Microsoft. he was saying that after ServiceCore had been out for a year and some, I'm going to get these numbers wrong, so forgive me, Andrew, if you're listening. But it was something like, if you take all the updates without looking, there were 59% fewer updates on ServiceCore than there was on 08.
Nice.
Full-blown server. And a lot of it comes down to Internet Explorer, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Because I know for myself, what could be more frustrating than when you're sitting at your web server, your important enterprise web server that people from around the world do business with you with, and you're forced to reboot it because there's an update in IE.
Yeah.
Why do I have to reboot my computer with a change in IE? It's a freaking application. It's like saying, oh, we've changed Word, now you have to reboot your computer.
Yeah, no. Remember, IE is core to the operating system. No, Microsoft told the Department of Justice that.
Yes, they did. They did. And the Department of Justice believed it, too, which is fascinating.
It is fascinating.
But and, you know, I've never been a big browser guy. I don't really care. I'm not religious about my browser, and I'm lazy.
Yeah.
So I've been an IE person for the longest time. IE 8 is convincing me that maybe I have to learn Firefox.
Interesting.
And IE 9, we'll see. And by the way, that leads me to the number one thing that I think we need on Windows 8. I think on Windows 8, we need a no-reboot policy.
A no-reboot policy.
I'll give you an example. So I have been playing with Microsoft Security Essentials. It's Microsoft's free antivirus program. And the reason that I did it is because I don't use antivirus software. I don't use anti-malware software because I think the most effective anti-malware tool is a working brain.
Yep.
If I get an email from my friend Richard and I wasn't expecting it, there's a PIF for an attachment, and Richard has lost the power of grammar and spelling, okay, that's a clue, you know?
Yep, it's a hint. But even, you know, I've just gotten in the habit of, if you send me an attachment unexpectedly, I call you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, but a lot of people ask me about, you know, what's good antivirus software? People told me that Microsoft Security Essentials is pretty good, not a lot of overhead, and I've been playing with it. I just installed it to see how it works. Does it annoy me? Does it get in the way? It's a very, very nice piece of software, and the price is right. Yeah. The weird part, though, is that there's something about the way that Windows loads drivers such that many pattern file updates of Microsoft Security Essentials requires that I reboot the computer. So that's like, that should have someone fired. Somebody should be fired for that.
Yeah, no, I like the idea that Microsoft makes a mandate internally that anytime you're going to ship anything that's going to require reboot of the computer, you have to go before Bomber or something. Like, you have them fear it so much that they go to the nth degree to avoid reboots. Because I just don't see an excuse. And maybe this happens all the way at the bottom level of the Windows, that we have to architect Windows differently so that anything can be restarted.
I got one word here. Linux.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. I can restart the network stack in Linux without rebooting the machine.
Exactly.
And the funny thing, my experience in Linux, I still have a Linux box running in my closet, is that I fear rebooting Linux.
I'm sorry. The idea of you not having skeletons in your closet, but Linux boxes.
I still have a Linux box in my closet. I'm not afraid. It is a skeleton of a machine. But the story of that computer is an interesting one all by itself. But I actually fear, the correct answer to almost any Windows Server problem is reboot the machine. For better or worse.
The two most effective Microsoft repair tools are reboot and reinstall.
Stunningly effective. But my general experience with Linux boxes has been that rebooting it is the wrong thing to do. Odds are you will make, the thing with restarting Windows is it generally makes things better. The problem with restarting Linux is it generally makes things worse.
And that's, that's actually a very old story, because when I used to tell this story in the early 80s when I was talking about PCs, that, if you run a mainframe, when I used to do IBM mainframe stuff, UNIFAC mainframe stuff, the last thing you wanted to do was reboot the mainframe.
Right.
Because that's when you'd find out some stuff that had broken that you hadn't noticed before because it doesn't like being restarted or something along those lines. But that was always a bad thing.
But there was also a machine where you could shut down an individual CPU, swap it out, and then bring it back in again.
Exactly. So Security Essentials actually factored into a kind of fun thing that happened to me. The other day, we were talking about upgrading to 2008 R2. And so I have a domain controller, and I thought, it's time for me to add another domain controller, and let's do an 08 R2 domain controller so I can decommission the first one. And I've got an extra domain controller that's a virtual machine. It's not a big domain, so I've got my two DCs, and it's really not a high value network in the sense that I do image backups every night. And even if I lose the domain controller, nothing bad happens, So I ran over to Best Buy because I needed a new computer, and I found a 64-bit computer with, a couple of gigs of RAM and hard drive or something. And again, this is a cheap machine,
Yep.
Oh, my God, why are we buying this terrible hardware? Because I have, like, six people in my domain, and because we have another domain controller, and because I have image backups. And so in the end analysis, me going out and spending $2,000 for some really snazzy server doesn't make any sense at all.
No.
Anyway, so I don't know if you've, but you guys have Best Buy up there?
Yeah, we have Best Buy up here. What we don't have is Fry's.
What you don't have is what?
Fry's Electronics.
You know what? Fry's is a little overrated, I think. I don't think you missed anything. And I'm sure Canadian Tire has some great deals on computers. Anyway, so I buy this computer. It's like over $300, which right. is astounding because the first 320K double-sided floppy drive that I bought was $450. I'm astounded. I'm buying this 64-bit system with a couple of gigs of RAM and so on and so on and so on. State-of-the-art, you know, NIC and unbelievable.
$300.
And so when you go to buy Best Buy, then they want to sell you other stuff.
Right.
And so you can't just walk up with a box and give them a credit card. No, you have to go talk to the Geek Squad advisor or counselor or something. And really what they want to do is they want to sell you this $129 package where you get Kaspersky Labs antivirus. And I'm sure Kaspersky Labs is fine. I'm not picking on these guys. And some other nonsense. It's just, it's the same as getting undercoated.
You're being upsold.
And so I said, look, I'm kind of in a rush. Really, I don't need that. And the Geek Squad guy, he's like 23 or something, is absolutely insisting. I said, look, really, I know what I'm doing. I don't need this. Well, you know, computers need anti-malware. I said, well, you know, domain controllers don't, as it turns out. I don't need any virus software in my domain controller, right?
Right.
That took me back for a moment. Okay, my trouble with the Geek Squad is that these people aren't technical. They're salespeople making believe they're technical experts.
Okay.
And they're gulling people into buying junk. So this is not a story about Mark being smarter than them. This is a story about, well, you know what this is like. Almost anyone listening right now, let me ask you, have you ever walked into a computer store because you need a cable or something, and you overhear one of the sales consultants giving horrible advice that's going to waste people's money, and there's like this, you know, the shaking happens, like
oh, yeah.
the Hulk.
You start to vibrate.
And like, you know, must control, fist of death, just, you know, I'm just going to get out of here quickly. And I'd been doing that for the last 15 minutes, and that was the last straw. And I said to the guy, I said, listen, domain controllers don't need anti-malware software. And he said, he thought about it for a second and said, well, I wouldn't use this machine as an anti-malware, as a domain controller. I said, good, that's great. So we're going to move along though, right? He says, well, no, we have to. I said, look, do you really want to do this? And he says, what do you mean? I said, do we really have to have this conversation? And he says, you know, well, sir, we're just trying to help you. I said, no, you're not. You're trying to sell me stuff. He wouldn't let me go. So I amped up the voice to theater voice.
Right.
And there's like five tables where they're talking to people. I said, the first thing you want to do is sell me anti-malware software, which I don't actually need, because wouldn't a better idea be to download Microsoft Security Essentials? And all the heads pop up, it's a free product from Microsoft. As a matter of fact, it has less overhead than almost all other anti-malware software. And I just went all like this, and I said, do you want to keep going?
Yeah.
So, I mean, other days you just want to say, Google my name.
Yeah.
No, and I don't mean that in the sense of, you know, Google the wonderful Mark Manassi's name. I'm just saying any of us.
Yeah, any of us could actually do
this.
You put
the resume on Monster and stuff like that, so it's got to be clear that you know what, you know.
No, I think, my line generally is you've got about 30 seconds before you blow this sale. Right? Like, look, I know you're being listened to and you're trying to upsell me, so now I'm trying to go the other way. You're going to make no money if you keep talking. The correct answer now is yes, sir, and take my credit card.
Exactly. The number two thing we ought to have in Windows, so to review.
This is three now, I think, because the first one is
the
no
first
reboots.
No reboots, right?
Yep. Second one, Security Essentials.
I'm sorry? No. That was just a side thing. That was
okay.
Just I was saying. If there's anybody out there and your mom needs security, your mom needs antivirus software, and you find that some of the big names cause more trouble than they, you know, than they avert.
Right.
Then, you know, look at Security Essentials. I don't care whether you buy it or not because you don't have to. It's free, you know.
Right.
And so no reboot stuff. There really should not be a reason. I mean, adding a printer driver should
why
not involve a reboot.
Why is this such a pain? Why is everything related to printing horrible?
You know what? That's on my wish list for the wonderful future. The wonderful future is where we don't have printers at all, and I just print to my Kindle.
Well, so far, the printer companies have been doing a good job of making that come true by making printing so painful.
It's insane. And first is the mechanical part, right? But the other part is just...
Oh, the drivers are appallingly bad.
Well, also, think about this, Richard. Where do you go to see what hard drives you're connected to? Device manager. Where do you go to find out what kind of video board you have? device manager, and so on and so on. What's the one piece of hardware that is so lame that it's not even a device manager? That'd be printers. Anyway, so let's go. Number two.
Yes.
Number two, we need a desktop hypervisor. Windows needs to be like, Windows desktop needs to be like Hyper D, you know, not Hyper V, but Hyper D for desktop. There are so many things we could do with it. But the number one is we build a incredibly simple virtual machine and use that for surfing. Use that for Internet Explorer kinds of stuff.
So that, yeah, all that surfing stuff, all of that risk is automatically in a can.
It not only is it in a can, but as you know, we got snapshots.
Right.
And what if, so here's my simple-minded model of how surfing would work out. I want to go get Windows 7 Service Pack 3. And I probably trust Microsoft. That's fine. But, I mean, let's just assume that it's a scarier world 3 years from now than it is now. And it probably will be, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to pull that stuff down. And so I'm surfing in a virtual machine where I've already done a snapshot before I get started.
Yep.
Which means the worst thing that happens is I roll back the snapshot. I grab the file. And at that point, I'm going to do a drag and drop, you know, from one virtual machine to another. And maybe at that point, something along the lines of Security Essentials is built in, which means as I'm dragging something from one virtual machine to my desktop or whatever, that it's doing a scan on it. Now, let's be clear. I realize there's a lot of problems when it comes to the whole notion of scans and pattern files and stuff like that. But, you know, 99% of the trouble, I think, can be eliminated in that manner.
Well, I think the argument you're making here is that the default that's that anytime you run something, it's altering your machine is a mistake. I would make sense to me that there's a VM that's essentially in kiosk mode for any browsing I want to do. In fact, that should just be when I run Internet Explorer or any other browser. What if every application lived in essentially its own VM, and you, part of its installation is you decide the VM it's going to run in, and whether or not, as soon as I close this, roll it back. Presume I never want to keep anything. And for browsing, that's like true 99% of the time.
Absolutely.
Make the exception case the hard case, that the few times I want to keep things, I have to go an extra step. I have to do it deliberately. I have to paint intent to keep something.
And along those lines, as we move more and more to a world where, I'm not happy about this, but I think it makes sense for a lot of people, where we're storing our data in the documents folder, or more likely one of the libraries.
Right.
And so now I'm at one of these virtual machines, the surfing virtual machine. And when I click rollback, rollback is smart enough to say, you know what? You changed many files, all kinds of temp files have changed and crap like that. But the ones in the documents folder, I notice that these two are new or have changed. And much in the same way that if I try to shut down my computer while several applications are running, it shows me just who those guys are so I can say, I don't care, shut down anyway.
Yeah, take it away.
You know, it'd be neat if we could do that same sort of thing in a snapshot model.
Well, and essentially, the VM becomes the journaling mechanism. But we're also speaking to the fact that we've never solved the user security problem effectively to have a shared environment.
So, and it's getting worse, and it's getting worse in a way that many people don't realize. If we look at the CERT stuff, Computer Emergency Response Team site, they look at, as you know, they look at all the vulnerabilities that appeared in Apple, Linux, Windows, et cetera, over the years. And it always just boils down to, well, there's this vulnerability in Windows. And I don't know how closely you follow this, because I know you're a busy guy this year. But do you know what the number one is now? It's not Windows, and it's not Linux, and it's not Mac.
It's
Adobe.
Adobe, yeah.
Adobe Acrobat. And I'm not saying the Adobe guys are doing a bad job. It's not at all. Here's what's happened, Richard, I think, is that Microsoft's been yelled at for so many years about let's get more secure. And, you know, they're trying. I mean, they're not succeeding entirely. But I think they are no longer the lowest hanging fruit.
Right. They've gotten hard enough that there are easier vectors to exploit.
Exactly. I mean, and because Adobe Acrobat is a cross-platform tool.
Yep.
I mean, I would much rather exploit that, get the Mac guys, well, not if Steve gets his way, but I mean, you know, get the Mac guys, the Linux guys, the Sun guys, and the Windows guys.
Yeah.
And if we look at a model where we're isolating our applications into different virtual machines, and the virtual machine snapshot model is smart enough to recognize new files, which means, you know, the scanning becomes quite a bit easier, then maybe this all starts to make, you know, then we think of applications, as you said, all of them being different virtual machines, And the cool thing is they don't talk to each other at all, except for the treaties that you negotiate, so to speak,
right,
between the different applications.
It's only by intent, right? That it's only deliberate that, yes, go ahead, let that talk to that.
And it's going to have to be wizard-based because, you know, my dad's not going to understand how to do that stuff.
Now, generally speaking, like you say, all the UAC dialogues and so forth, for the average mortal, the OK button really means let me do what I want to do.
Right.
Right. They're not actually thinking about the security implications. They're just trying to get what they were trying to do done. So, you know, you're fooling yourself when you, why pop a dialogue to someone who cannot answer the question?
Yeah, and along those same lines, maybe we're jumping back to Office for a moment, but let me give an example of where life could be better there. And this is not my idea, by the way. There is a man, I wish I could remember his name, it's Alan Codd or something like that. Not as in Codd and date, but there's, anyway, very, very smart man. He's written a couple of books about programming and interfaces and how interfaces should be. And he's got a lot of really clever thoughts. And the story he tells is, so my mom is using Microsoft Word. She's got a document the way she likes it. She saves the document. Oh, but then she says, let me print it. She prints the document. She goes to exit the document, and now it says, do you want to save changes? And his mom is smart, and she's like, I didn't friggin' change anything. And, of course, what she changed was the fact that there's a particular printer that's kind of its, I don't even know, Richard. Is it his favorite printer at this point? I have no idea. Wow. Anyway, Alan's observation, I wish I could remember the man's name. His observation was, you know what? I get, what, 9 undos in Word? Why don't I get undos between sessions?
Right.
So, like, if I've opened this document and I did something stupid last time, I should get those 9 rollbacks. They shouldn't go away.
Yeah.
It's not like we don't have enough hard drive space, for goodness sake.
No. Yeah, we're up to our hip weight drive space. You know, there's another side to this whole virtualization model that I think is really important, and that is that the number of cores on the desktop by the time Windows 8 ship is going to be catastrophic.
At least 4.
Well, no, look, July 2010, right? Right now, I can buy a 12-core desktop machine. One chip, 12 cores in it, right?
A 12-core desktop, yes, absolutely.
I'm talking about desktop machines. And
who
that number is
going to be
only
buying desktop machines in 2015, though?
Well, it's an interesting question all by itself, but the reality is the number of cores is going up dramatically.
Right.
And I don't believe that developers are going to figure out how to use them well themselves. I think the operating system has to be a big part of utilizing many, many cores well. And virtualization just lends itself to that. If I'm creating a VM for every app, that's automatically getting core and memory assignment to it.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting you say that because many times people say to me, they want to hear that Windows 7 is faster than XP.
Yeah.
And of course, it can't be. There are a few edge conditions, though. One is that if you had a 4-core or an 8-core system, mm-hmm. you put XP on it. Well, XP was built in a world where, you know,
there is only one
desktop
core.
Would have one core.
Yeah.
And if you took XP and put it on that 8-core system versus putting Windows 7 on the 8-core system, you would probably see that Windows 7, or with hope, Windows 8, would be faster about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about, here's another one. How about renaming my computer? Maybe I'm just a reboot. Maybe I'm just itchy. Maybe I'm allergic to reboots. But in the Linux world, me renaming my Linux desktop is a simple matter.
Not a big deal. But how often does that really happen?
Well, for me, it happens a lot because I'm often configuring systems.
Right.
So I see your point that once I've got my desktop running, then I might not need to rename it. But what I think what it boils down to is, you know, Microsoft's doing a lot of work on this MinWin, where they're trying to build the smallest kernel that is Windows. It's got no GUI and things like that. So that ultimately, Windows 8, Windows 9, Windows 10, we will see something that looks a lot like a Linux in the sense of when you start it up, you could start it up from just a command prompt. Mm-hmm. And that would be pretty groovy. And you could just turn the GUI on when you need it and then turn it off. And that's always sort of been, for me, that's what server core should be.
Right.
And perhaps for my desktop as well. I mean, I tend to want to leave my machine on because I notice that the, you know, when do light bulbs burn out when you turn them on, right?
Yeah.
Or off. And it would be cool if I could shut most of it off, which means that I'm not burning that much power and stuff like that. And that would be a step in that right direction. I think it would be nice to be able to say, I want to boot to an actual command prompt, to a very simple command shell without any GUI stuff at all. That would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what else. Here's another one too that drives me crazy all the time is when I'm going to reboot my computer. many times I'm going to reboot the computer and I want to do something like go directly into the BIOS to do something.
Yep.
Now, that was fine in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
But now what does that mean I have to do? Now I reboot my computer, which has got 65 zillion cores, and it's running at several teraflops and this sort of thing, which means I've got to hit the escape key just at the right time. And, you know, let's be clear. I've got quick fingers. In 1980, I was the Washington, D.C. area Tempest champion, but that was 30 years ago. And so I'm thinking to myself that if Microsoft talked to the hardware vendors, we have several shutdown options now, right? We've got go to sleep, we've got shutdown, we've got reboot. It would be cool if I had reboot to the BIOS.
Right.
We would need some hardware. You know, there'd have to be a little bit of hardware support there.
Yeah, there needs to be some way for the OS to communicate down to the low level of hardware and say, hey, when you start up again, drop to the BIOS window.
Exactly.
But,
exactly.
You know, that's they do this interaction all the time. There's all of these power saving settings and so forth that are in the BIOS that Windows has to read. Like, this is not a stretch. It's an easy one.
Yeah. I mean, no. Well, help, look at, I mean, if they can put TPM chips on the motherboards of most laptops and desktops and more servers, I mean, that's something that needs a lot of BIOS support. That seems like a much, being able to reboot to the BIOS seems like a much simpler sort of thing. So I don't know. Let's see. Here's my number one. I think my number one, as a guy that has to help people manage systems, is that it feels like such a patchwork to run Windows. Because honestly, if you're going to do everything, if you're going to take advantage of everything that Windows has to let you take advantage of, some of these things, the only way to do it is to turn on some item in group policies.
Right.
And you know, many group policies, as I'm sure you know, are really nothing more than registry entries, just a fancy way of doing registry entries, but yeah. Not everyone. And so some of these things got to be group policy. Mm-hmm. Other things must be from the command line. I mean, a classic example of that is that when Vista and Server 2008 came out, you were talking about the network stack before, Microsoft rewrote the TCP stack as well as the IP stack.
Yes.
The IP stack's kind of interesting. The IPv4 stack actually runs entirely through the V6 stack,
now,
which means that even if you think you've turned off IPv6 on Vista or Windows 7, you haven't. They're still there.
It's just like trying to turn off TCP/IP, period, in the system. Like, you just can't. It's core to the system now.
And so one of the things that happened was that in the early internet, you could not have a TCP block bigger than 64K. And that's
right.
Because, well, you know, I mean, we just weren't running that fast at the time, and computers didn't have much RAM. In 1993, people started saying, you know what? Yeah, I am. And I did say that right 17 years ago. The internet guys are saying, well, you know, the thing is that internet's getting faster. We've got more RAM on our systems. 64K is a bit of a straitjacket. So they promulgate RFC 1323. And yes, it is sad that I know RFC numbers. And what's even sadder is knowing knowledge base article numbers. That's
yes.
When you know that it's time for a long vacation.
You're memorizing six-digit numbers for knowledge base articles.
No, it's not memorizing. It's just you look at them enough that it just falls out of your mouth without you realizing it. Those are the days that you say, time for a vacation.
Yeah, I need a hobby.
And anyway, so RFC 1323 says this is how you can have blocks bigger than 64K, and indeed blocks as large as 1 gigabyte in size. So that's cool. If you've got a faster network, you've got a cleaner network, it makes sense to have those bigger blocks.
Right.
Well, unfortunately, Windows never didn't really support that. I mean, unless you knew how to hack around the registry, Windows did not support that until the appearance of Vista. So from 1993 to 2007, there was no Microsoft support for that stuff. Well, now automatically, Windows Vista and Windows 7, when talking to Server 08 and 08R2, can negotiate blocks bigger than 64K.
Mm-hmm.
And that's groovy. And what's neat about this is you don't have to do a darn thing. It does it automatically. And in general, that means that your speed is at least as good as XP and possibly better in some situations.
Right.
The problem is that the whole RFC 1323 thing that Windows didn't support very well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because Windows didn't support it, I think an awful lot of vendors, the Linksys and the
yes.
Netgears and those guys.
All the lightweight networking gear. We ran into this problem right after Vista shipped with variable length packet size with MTU changes, where
right.
these boxes just exploded.
Yes. I was at a conference with, I don't know if you know Todd Lamley. He's a super smart guy about Cisco stuff,
mm-hmm.
a good buddy of mine. And we were at this conference. It was a Tech Mentor conference in Orlando. And it was just maybe 2 months after Vista came out. And their poor little Netgear or Linksys device that they were using to provide wireless services for the 200 people at the conference kept dying.
Hmm.
And so Todd and I were about to head off to the bar because we were done for the day. Somebody said, help, come here. And Todd was kind of looking sort of funny, but he knows a lot about Cisco and that sort of thing. But I said, I know what this is. And we ran a trace on it. And every time a VistaBox fired up wirelessly and tried to talk to that, the poor little Netgear or Linksys thing, it just went belly up.
Right.
And this can happen in any of the networks of the people that we're listening to. Because again, let's understand the story. You've got Windows 7 on the desktop. You've got 08 or 08R2 on the server side. And you didn't do anything wrong. But when they start to negotiate a block size bigger than 64K, the pieces in between, your smooth wall or your, you know, some kind of weird router or whatever, doesn't quite hear them right.
Yeah.
And so what ends up happening is you're dropping a lot of packets on the floor. Your network connections are getting TCP resets. Maybe they're stopping altogether. Maybe they're a lot slower. You do a test with your old stuff. You say, gosh, XP in 2003 run great. Windows 7 and 08R2, man, they just, you know, suck dead donkeys.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem isn't Windows. It's that there's some device in between. And so the troubleshooting tool, and I am getting back to my original point, the troubleshooting tool is you can say to Windows 7 and 08, look, I surrender. Never negotiate a block size bigger than 64K. You know, go back to being XP
yeah.
when it comes to TCP stack. And that's a command that you can only do from the command line. It's
yes.
a netch int TCP set global auto tuning level equals disabled.
Disabled, yeah.
And by the way, 9 out of 10 web pages that refer to this, so you have to reboot to make this take effect, and they're dead, dead wrong. I mean, it's one thing to copy stuff from other people's web pages so you have some stuff to put on your website. It's another to not actually test it when it's really easy to test it, you know? Only command line. You can't
right.
do that with a group
no
policy.
Other way.
You can't do it from the GUI. And then there's things, as you know, that you can only get to from the GUI. Well, I think if I could have just one wish for Windows, it would be that anything that you can do from the command line, you could do from a group policy, and you could do from the GUI. Anything you do from the GUI, you could do from a group policy and a command line, and anything you do with a group policy, you can do from the GUI, you can do from a command line. That would be the ultimate in Windows administration.
That is a great wish. And you know, there's some products that are headed that way. Like IIS 7 has done a good job of that because they built it using PowerShell and then built the GUI over PowerShell.
Absolutely.
In the end, everything in the GUI is just becomes PowerShell commands under the hood.
No, absolutely. The Exchange guys were the first ones with that. The System Center Virtual Machine Manager guys, and I know that to sound like one of the cool kids, I'm supposed to just say Virtual Machine Manager or VMM, but you know, I think there's people out there that don't know what we're talking about. And they control it through PowerShell, and they do that thing that Jeff Snover's original vision that not everyone else has done, which is, well, you're sitting there clicking buttons on the GUI, you don't realize that under the hood, all the GUI's doing is generating PowerShell commands and
yep.
then shooting them off. And so the groovy thing about this is that you could push this little button, and you get this essentially notepad, and it shows you what the PowerShell commands are
right.
that correspond to the button you just pushed. You know what? That is exactly. That was Jeff's vision when he first talked to me about PowerShell back in 2003, was that he said, you know, so the deal is that it's almost like you have this glide path, this reverse glide path where you start out as just a GUI guy, and then you start opening up the Monad browser, that was what it was called at the time, and you see these commands. So, you know, now you know what you can do from the command line. And once you start doing the command line, you say, well, you know, I'm always typing these three commands together, and then you package them up, and that becomes a script, and then, you know, perhaps one is a PowerShell compiler and stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Active Directory team did not do that. They have a tool called Active Directory Administrative Center. And that is along the same lines as the Exchange System Manager, whatever it's called these days, the management GUI for VMM and so on. But unfortunately, you can't push a button and see what the commands are going to be. I'm told that may change in Windows 8. That would be absolutely totally groovy.
That would be awesome. Hey, I know we haven't done as many things as we wanted to about talking about these different Windows 8 versions.
But we are running out of time.
We are running out of time. But we got the email address up there, info@runasradio.com. So maybe the listeners can send us things they'd like to see in Windows 8 as well, and we can revisit this.
I would love to see those. Please,
we've got some time.
Do those, or you know what? You could always, anybody listening can drop me an idea at help@minasi.com.
Excellent. Mark, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Richard. Take care, man.
You bet. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.